From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Writing is a strange act anyway. You sort of always feel a bit silly doing it. You're basically making things up. And I think that, yeah, that the only reason why sometimes you have the confidence to do that is because you know it's going to go on somewhere. Someone has programmed it. That's a hell of a motivator to get something done.
James Graham wrote the play Quiz about an alleged cheating scandal on the British version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire before he adapted it for TV. It's now playing on AMC. These dark times should provide a lot of material for Graham, who often writes about big political and cultural moments, but he's finding it hard to get started. Graham tells us about beginning to doubt the conventional wisdom about Charles and Diana Ingram, a couple accused of cheating on Millionaire and, in effect, stealing £1 million in 2001 in front of a studio audience. And he wonders whether, with his earlier project on Brexit, he inadvertently gave a career boost to the then little-known Boris Johnson advisor Dominic Cummings, a moving force behind Brexit. But first on the News Banter, how is Hollywood meeting this moment? Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague in Banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
Well, so we are in the midst of a very significant time in the country, obviously. What we have to hope, I think, is that this leads to something meaningful and lasting in terms of change for very, very long festering problems in American society and culture. Dealing with the Hollywood element of this, you know, what we have seen is the heads of pretty much all the companies putting out statements. And I'm not saying it's an easy thing to address this because there is a lot of anger and there's been a lot of inaction. And therefore, when you put out a statement, it's hard to sound compelling and real. But I have to say, somebody I know who works in this business texted me after Brian Roberts of Comcast put out a sort of anodyne statement of, you know, I support, I'm so shocked, am I, we stand with, that kind of thing, said that they thought the Peloton statement was better, more emotional, more convincing. And that has been a response to several of these.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I've talked to a couple people that have been involved in the creation of these statements, and they say, you know, it's kind of a no-win for them because these corporate entities are such targets. If a word is not as sensitive as it should be, or if the sentiment doesn't go far enough, you know, not everyone can be Ben and Jerry's, which put out a very forceful statement referring to slavery and all sorts of things and became the toast of Twitter. But that's not going to happen from the Walt Disney Company. But that said, some of these statements are just, you know, they're circular and benign and say nothing. And the Disney statement in particular from Bob Chapek, I thought was pretty weak. But then in response to that, a lot of people started circulating these grids that showed how so many companies were putting out statements, but then not following it up with donations to these causes. So we're seeing a second round of these companies now, like Disney, which donated $5 million to the NAACP and different African-American-oriented causes. And Netflix CEO Reed Hastings donated $1 million personally to the Center for Policing Equity, which is one of the causes that has emerged. So, you know, companies are doing it, probably not enough. And they're doing it in this environment where they're under such close scrutiny.
You know, I would say the moment calls for them to go maybe not all the way to the Ben and Jerry's, but further. I don't see why they can't issue some strong language. If we're going to have change, somebody has to stand up. I want to give a little special love here to Lachlan Murdoch, though. Lachlan Murdoch of Fox actually sent out a memo to staff. Oh, the events have left me shocked and saddened, and each of you are in my thoughts. And the Fox culture, this is my favorite part, embraces and fosters diversity and inclusion. We support Black colleagues and the Black community. We all unite to seek equality and understanding. I mean, I'm sorry, but no. Are you kidding me? But no.
Yeah, I got a couple of texts from people that work at Fox with, you know, LOLs and the laughing, crying emoji attached to that statement, because clearly Fox News is fostering and, in many people's eyes, inflaming this division that's going on right now with some of the rhetoric that's being espoused on that network. Lachlan Murdoch is very well aware of the criticism of Fox News, and that statement just sort of fell flat.
Oh, more than flat. I mean, yeah, they also make interesting news choices. Meanwhile, Don Lemon on CNN on Saturday, the 30th of May, he had some words for Hollywood.
Get on television or do something and help these young people instead of sitting in your mansions and doing nothing, and have some moral courage and stop worrying about your reputation and your brand.
And then we saw a couple of days later, Jamie Foxx at a demonstration in San Francisco with a similar message.
And what I want to say about my Hollywood friends, you got to get out here. You got to come out here. You can't sit back. You can't tweet. You can't text. You got to get out here.
And then, you know, we did start to see celebrities. Kiki Palmer went pretty viral when she confronted some members of the National Guard at a demonstration in L.A. We'll hear from her, and then we'll hear from John Boyega in London.
March beside us. Let the revolution be televised. March beside us and show us that you're here for us. Make history with us, please. Let's just do it. March with us. We'll start marching. You march with us.
Black men, it starts with you. And it's done, man. We can't be trust no more. We have to be better. Do you not understand? I'm speaking to you from my heart. Look, I don't know if I'm going to have a career after this.
So as you hear, John Boyega brings up the question of repercussions to his career. Matthew Cherry, who made the Oscar-winning short Hair Love, he tweeted out asking who in the community of Hollywood will make sure that John Boyega and Kiki Palmer are working and not there's no retaliation. And there was a response that, you know, I think I hope was heartfelt and encouraging.
At least on social media, there was. We'll see if it actually happens. I mean, you saw creators like Jordan Peele and Phil Lord, the film and television producer, and Rian Johnson, who directed Boyega in Star Wars, and a couple of others really come out strongly and saying, we got you. And, you know, we think he's an amazing performer and he's going to be, you know, working after this. So I think, you know, at least in the short term, you're seeing the creative community rally around these people. Whether that will translate into the true decision makers, the powers that be that green light a lot of this content, we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, the main thing here is that we've been hearing for a long, long time about representation of women, African-Americans, people of color generally, in the executive suites. You know, this is where Hollywood doesn't change. And we've seen statistics barely move, incrementally move. And that is where all power lies. You know, this is where decisions are made about who gets to work in front of and behind the camera and what is seen on the big screen. And if there's one thing we've understood as the culture has gradually changed, is what it means for kids to see themselves represented on the screen. And that kind of thing doesn't happen effectively when people from those communities are not deciding what is on the screen, not making the judgment calls, not having control of the purse strings. So that's where we really need to see change. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The new TV miniseries Quiz was a big hit in the UK. It's airing now on AMC. James Graham adapted Quiz from his play of the same name. It tells the story of Charles and Diana Ingram, a well-to-do UK couple accused of stealing £1 million by using strategic coughs to cheat on the game show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? That happened in 2001, when Millionaire was a huge hit in Britain and on its way to becoming a worldwide phenomenon. As we see in the series, Diana Ingram, played by Sean Clifford, is obsessed with pub quizzes and game shows. She even gets on Millionaire herself, but isn't satisfied with her win of £32,000. Her husband, Charles, played by Matthew McFadyen, seems to be just a nice but bumbling major in the British Army with no interest in getting on the show. But with Diana's prodding, he ends up in the finalist's hot seat. At first, he performs poorly, quickly using up all three of his lifelines. But then his strategy seems to shift. On a question worth £16,000 about which UK artist had a hit album in the previous year, Charles says he's going to pick the boy band A1. But then he reads through the other options out loud. Meanwhile, his wife Diana, sitting in the audience, suddenly has a tickle in her throat.
Craig David. You know, when I'm at home and I'm practicing, you know, I guess wrong 80% of the time. So I think I'm going to go with Craig David.
Charles, you'd never heard of him a moment ago.
No, Craig David. We're going to...
Final answer.
Yeah, final answer.
Michael Sheen plays millionaire host Chris Tarrant, who continues to be gobsmacked as Charles repeatedly leans towards wrong answers before switching to the right ones. Soon, Charles and Diana, yes, that was actually the names of the real-life couple, stand accused of bilking the show out of £1 million. James Graham wrote both the play quiz and its TV adaptation. He's a fan of examining culture and current events. He wrote a play about Rupert Murdoch and was the screenwriter on the film Brexit, the Uncivil War. In that movie, which aired on HBO, Benedict Cumberbatch played Dominic Cummings, now a key advisor to Boris Johnson. He stirred outrage in Britain lately for egregiously breaking lockdown rules. When Graham wrote about him, Cummings was a little-known strategist who organized the Vote Leave campaign and won a surprise victory in a 2016 referendum.
If you find a potential voter, you hit them hard, and if it looks like they're going to bend, then you don't just walk away, pat yourself on the back, you double down, hit them again and again.
The reason why I picked Dominic Cummings to be the central protagonist was because he was a very little-known figure in the country, behind the scenes, not the public-facing politician. And yes, we sort of dragged him forward from the darkness into the light, and now he's at the very center of our political, ideological life. And he did this extraordinary thing a few weeks ago in breaking his own lockdown rules, many people think.
I think I read somewhere that you felt a little sad that now everybody's heard of him because you had discovered him when he was kind of lurking and out of the public eye.
Yeah, there's a part of that. I mean, some people actually go further and blame me specifically for creating the cult around him because, I mean, to be fair, if I was going to blame anyone, it would be Benedict Cumberbatch. I think if you cast anybody as a Marvel superhero, their position is going to be elevated slightly in the public consciousness. But no, people to this day, even very serious journalists or political commentators say had Benedict Cumberbatch not played him, he wouldn't have found himself at the heart of Downing Street and or been behaving the way he is behaving, because I guess when Doctor Strange plays you, you feel a puffed up sense of confidence and you start behaving a little differently. You know, I spend hours of every day trying to convince people of the power of drama, but I don't think I can quite take credit for changing our history in that way.
I promise I'm going to get to quiz, but I have to ask just a little bit. I just can't help myself, so forgive. You took on Rupert Murdoch in Ink, which is something that I would love to see. They're also an irresistible subject. You took a sort of an offbeat approach. It seems to be something you like to do, is to say, I'm going to take this giant topic, but come at it this way.
Yeah, well, I think the offbeat approach to me isn't even that controversial or radical, but I guess in the age of the social media age of everything being binary or black and white or this or that, the approach is basically to try and add a bit of aggressive reasonableness into the conversation, even when that features very controversial figures like Dominic Cummings or Rupert Murdoch. So with Murdoch, it was a help that the story I was interested in was the purchase of his very first newspaper in the 1960s in London. And so he's a young man. He's not quite fully formed yet. I always sort of joke that it was a bit like the Star Wars prequels. He's not Darth Vader yet. He's this wide-eyed Anakin Skywalker who's trying to learn all of the things that frightens him and what he wants. So I think that naturally made him a little bit more of a sympathetic character, even for those who disagree with him. But I guess fundamentally at the heart of the proposition of that play was taking a kind of news media that I would imagine the majority of quite liberal, progressive theatregoers would dismiss out of hand and just ask the question, what is it about this that really appeals to millions of people? The paper in question was called The Sun, and it went on to become the most popular paper in the English-speaking world. And we can either roll our eyes and just dismiss it, or we can have a more difficult, but I think more valuable conversation about what is it about that level of populist, sensational news that really cuts through for a lot of people. We don't have to endorse it, but we at least have to just not completely villainize it and demonize it and ask some sort of more grown-up questions.
I can't resist asking if you are a fan of Succession, because, of course, that's perceived as Murdoch's, plus a little, I think, Redstone's, but
yeah.
Largely Murdoch's.
Oh, my God, how can you not? I think it's one of the best examples of the golden age of television that we're living through. I think it's viciously witty, and I completely love it. And, of course, not to push the conversation towards quiz, but, of course, we share a star in the form of Matthew McFadyen. And I think, you know, he's just such a revelation in that, as the kind of ineffectual son-in-law, that we immediately wanted him to play the major in quiz.
Yes, I'm so struck by his transformation from a sort of a pretty sexy Darcy in Pride and Prejudice to dorky guy.
He's a beautiful man, Matthew, but his ability to be comic and tragic at the same time, I think leads him towards those slightly bigger characters.
So Quiz is another one of these things where you are taking something that is extremely well-known in Britain. I don't know if it was well-known here. Obviously, Millionaire, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, was huge in the US and became a huge thing for Disney and ABC. And you're taking something where everybody has assumed knowledge and you're saying not so fast.
Yeah, well, I think just in and of itself, I think the story of just the very idea of essentially a bank robbery film or a heist movie where you're looking at people trying to steal £1 million, but it's not Mission Impossible or Ocean's 11, it's a game show. And instead of guns and car chases, they have questions and answers. And I just thought that idea to, with a nod and a wink, try and create essentially a crime thriller, but the safe that these criminals are trying to break into is the most popular game show of all time. I think the mischievousness of that really, really satisfied me. But also, because the guilt to me seemed so self-evident 20 years ago when this crime was happening. And then it was actually a book, so I can't take any credit for it. A book came out called Bad Show by Bob Woffenden and James Plaskett, which was sort of a journalistic endeavour to reopen the case and present all of the many, many contradictions in the evidence that had them banged to rights. But actually, it's completely uncertain whether or not this bizarre crime happened whereby a guy was in the chair and Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and someone behind him was allegedly coughing whenever he listed the right answers. And I just thought it was, as you said, I thought it was so obvious when I was watching it. And now I don't necessarily think it is. But also, without getting overly pompous, it really appealed to me as a way to begin talking about what I think is the most vital issue of the day, which is the question of truth and the ability to know for definite whether something is correct or incorrect. And of course, that's the joy of a game show or a quiz. There is evidence-based proof that we all accept that something is right or something is wrong. And in an age when that feels under threat, it felt like a really useful way, and hopefully a very light touch way, to tap into those questions.
Coming up after a short break, Graham tells us how his play Quiz inspired a real-life meetup between the creator of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and the head of a secret organization devoted to rigging the show. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to James Graham, playwright and screenwriter of Quiz, a three-part miniseries now airing on AMC. Quiz tells the story of real-life couple Charles and Diana Ingram, who were charged with stealing £1 million on the game show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire in 2001. Their alleged plot relied on strategic coughs from a contestant in waiting, who appeared to guide the seemingly hapless Charles to the correct answer. In the TV series, as Charles is on his unusual winning streak, producer David Briggs, played by Elliot Levy, makes an urgent call to the show's creator, played by Mark Bonner.
The rollover contestant from last night, I think he's cheating.
What, in getting on the show?
Cheating on the show, cheating at the actual game.
You can't cheat the show. Either you know the answer or you don't.
Look, something isn't right. Normal people don't play like this.
In the years since the scandal, the team behind the show remains convinced of the Ingrams' guilt, while the couple maintains their innocence. Charles, who had been an officer in the army before the scandal forced him out, was villainized by the British tabloids as the coughing major. Before James Graham wrote the stage play Quiz, he wanted to talk to key people on both sides.
We managed to get to pretty much everybody. I sort of have a weird, it's not just a legal responsibility, though that too. I mean, it does help if you get everyone's permission to write about them. But no, we spoke to the major and his wife. And then the professor, whose name is very Welsh, is called Tecwyn Whittock, from the producer and creator of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, who's played by this amazing actor called Mark Bonner. Yeah, so we got them all in. We sort of got the people who absolutely believe in their guilt and absolutely believe in their innocence. And of course, their versions of events differ wildly, but in a helpful way to a writer, because in those gaps or in those overlaps, you can insert yourself and insert some mischievous dramatic license.
I assume you approached them for the play, and that, I don't know if you had to circle back on the film version, or did you?
Yeah, so actually this is really, what's glorious about doing a play version of it first is it's a physical place where people can come. And so all of the real life people would come and visit, and then we'd meet them afterwards, and I would jot down their email and their phone number. And it just meant that when we were turning it into a television show and sort of expanding the universe a little bit, we had all these contact details. And so very, very weirdly, I won't spoil this for people who are yet to see it or yet to get to the final episode, but one of my favourite aspects of this whole story, there was this whole culture that completely captivated a kind of middle-class professional subset of English society who, for whatever reason, got absolutely fixated by Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And they formalized this obsession into actual professional outfits. And we depict one of them, which we call the Syndicate. Their sole function was to find very, very clever people and get them into the chair on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And they worked out ways that they could game the phone lines. They obviously cheated in the extent that they were the phone a friend. They had this secret room in London where all of the phone calls were diverted to for their clients. So you have this obsessive subset of people, which I just love for all its English eccentricity. And we only really got to be able to fully put them on television because they came to see the play and we met them afterwards. And then we put them in contact with Paul Smith, the producer. And because of that, he learnt more about the extent to which this syndicate infiltrated his game show. And it's just a really glorious, joyful thing as a writer when the telling of the story actually starts to affect the story itself, because you learn more and more and more about it, and so do the real life people involved.
So basically, if I understand this correctly, whatever research you had done for the play became enhanced and augmented by the fact that the play was presented, and that then informed the film.
Exactly that. And it even informed a scene in the film. So at one point, the creator of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire decides to meet the head of the syndicate whose organization is trying to hack into his game show.
It's not what you think. I just wanted to meet, all right?
It's not illegal, what we do. Those were your weaknesses, your vulnerabilities that you left in your own system.
I'm not trying to trap you. I tip my hat to you. You beat us. I want to know how far you got.
And that was a real-life meeting facilitated by us. And when we were in pre-production for the drama, they met up and they buried the hatchet and they learned new information about how, you know, the thief and the catcher were operating. And so we got to feed that into the show as well. So it becomes quite meta, and you're in danger of falling into your own hole that you create.
So when you first approached these people, if I were either side of this controversy, I would say, well, how are you presenting me? And I can't imagine you were able to make anybody any promises. I mean, how did you finesse that situation?
I think it's about being completely sincere in your intentions. You have to acknowledge what the proposition is that they're going to. For example, when I approach the Ingrams, you say, here's what's good about it for you. We're going to, for the first time ever, really put forward your defense, and a mainstream audience is going to hear that. But there will also be a bit that, frankly, you won't like, because we're putting forward the prosecution case as well. You also want to lead them towards the tone of it. And there was a quietly comic tone to Quiz. So managing expectations around that there will be humour there. So, yeah, I think it's just about being honest from the very beginning. And that's the only way you can really take people with you.
I mean, I imagine with Charles Ingram, he would be very sensitive to the potential for being ridiculed in the thing.
Yeah, exactly. And to one extent, he's probably, bless him, he's probably painfully used to it. He's the archetypal military man who comes across quite bumbling and very posh. And the accusation that was leveled him in the media during the trial was that this man couldn't possibly win £1 million because he's an idiot. And actually, that's one of the first things I discovered that I didn't agree with in the perceived and the accepted narrative around this story, is that he's not an idiot. He's actually an incredibly smart man who I totally believe could have got £2 million on his own.
Wow. could have and maybe did or not.
And maybe did.
So was this, I'm not sure if this is a thing that AMC decided to broadcast because of the pandemic, because it was made, or was this deal in existence? Was it contemplated when this, I don't know when it was on the, you know, in Britain and versus now?
Oh yeah, I'm trying to jog my memory. So in Britain, it was broadcast at Easter time. So you go into production, we filmed about 7-8 months before that, and it was commissioned probably a year before it was broadcast here, so in the early 2019. So it takes a while, yeah. And obviously what we could not have predicted is two things. Firstly, the lockdown and how that affected how people would view the show, certainly in the UK. It was about the third week into quarantine and everyone staying at home. And apart from, you know, the tragedy around that, what it accidentally did in the UK at least was meant that everyone was stuck at home. And it's kind of a show about the phenomenon of event television, when a television show like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire captures a nation and it becomes a talking point across the country. So there was a really interesting accidental coincidence that, thankfully, I'm very grateful, Quiz became sort of the thing that the show is about, which is event television where everybody watches it at the same time and it feeds into people's understanding of something. It was kind of strange. The second thing to acknowledge, of course, is it's about a controversial cough. And
obviously, I was going to say,
yeah. And look, we had those urgent and serious conversations where we went, are people going to even remotely tolerate a slightly humorous show about a controversial cough, or will they just not want it? And I was kind of tracking social media a bit to see if people were going, this is outrageous, you can't be screening this. And thankfully they weren't. And what gratefully, what I'm pleased about is that it actually served as hopefully quite an entertaining distraction from the other controversial cough that we're all dealing with at the moment.
Let me just quickly ask you, you know, as a playwright, you have spoken about how you think theaters can't reopen, which clearly is going to be an enormous obstacle. And you feel that this can only happen at full capacity. I mean, is it just the feeling that socially distanced 25% capacity somehow won't be the same experience? Or some people might say, I'd rather have that than nothing.
Yeah, it's really tough, isn't it? I think mainly it's the economic argument that certainly here, certainly in London, there's no version of having a quarter full theatre where you can cover the cost of the production that audience is watching. And then I think you're right. I think it's about when we have Netflix and when we have, I can watch a superhero movie on my phone, what is the value of theatre? What does that offer that watching a multi-million dollar blockbuster on my computer doesn't offer? And it's the communal experience. It's being surrounded by people. Frankly, also, I just don't want it to feel, you know, I think it would remind you, if you're sat on a row all on your own, of how dangerous this is. And I think we just need people to be happy and confident when they return to the theatre. It may not be our choice because, you know, the idea of theatres being closed for a year is just so depressing and devastating. And I'm in danger of getting sentimental about the power of theatre, but I do think it has a social value as well as an emotional value, a mental health value for those who are lucky enough to get to go and see it. So if we think it's important, then its absence is also important, and we must lose something.
Are you writing plays in face of the future?
I am. It's hard because writing is a strange act anyway. You sort of always feel a bit silly doing it. You're basically making things up. And I think the only reason why sometimes you have the confidence to do that is because you know it's going to go on somewhere. Someone has programmed it. That's a hell of a motivator to get something done. It's quite hard at the moment to motivate yourself to begin something from scratch when the very survival of theatre feels so impossible at the moment. But I'm trying.
Yes, I think you should try. Playwright James Graham is the writer of the miniseries Quiz, now airing in the US on AMC. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with help from Kevin Tidmarsh, and Paul Smith mixed the show. No, not the Paul Smith who created Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, but he's just as famous to us. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business. Who wants a supersonic plane?